The light breeze was in their faces. The herd would not scent them. Although originally the herd had instinctively fled into the wind so as not to run into danger, the aircraft had turned them back downwind. The elephant's eyesight is not sharp. They would make nothing of the line of human figures until it was too late. The trap was set and the elephants were coming straight into it, chivied and sheepdogged by the low-flying Cessna. The two old cows burst out of their tree line at full run, their bony legs flying, ears cocked back, loose grey folds of skin shuddering and wobbling with each jarring footfall. The rest of the herd was strung out behind them. The youngest calves were tiring, and their mothers pushed them along with their trunks. The line of executioners froze, standing in a half circle, like the mouth of a gill net extended to take in a shoal of fish. The elephants would pick up movement more readily than they would recognize the blurred man-shapes that their weak, panic-stricken eyes disclosed to them. "Get the two old grannies first," Johnny called softly. He had recognized the matriarchs, and he knew that, with them gone, the herd would be disorganized and indecisive. His order was passed down the line. The leading cows pounded down directly towards where Johnny stood. He let them come on. He held the rifle at high port across his chest. At 100 yards distance, the two dowager elephants started to turn away from him, angling off to the left, and Johnny moved for the first time. He lifted his rifle and waved it over his head and shouted in Sindebele, "Nansi Nkosikazi! Here I am, respected old lady!" For the first time, the two elephants recognized that he was not a tree stump, but a deadly enemy. Instantly they swung back towards him, and focusing all their ancestral hatred and terror and concern for the herd upon him, they burst together into full charge. They squealed their fury at him, extending their stride so that the dust spurted from under their colossal footpads. Their ears were rolled back along the top edge, sure sign of their anger. They towered over the group of tiny human figures. Daniel wished vehemently that he had taken the precaution of arming himself. He had forgotten how terrifying this moment was, with the nearest cow only 50 yards away and coming straight in at 40 miles an hour. Jock was still filming, although the angry shrieks of the two cows had been taken up by the entire herd. They came down upon them like an avalanche of grey granite, as though a cliff had been brought rumbling down with high explosive. At 30 yards, Johnny Inzu mounted the rifle to his shoulder and leaned forward to absorb the recoil. There was no telescopic sight mounted above the blue steel barrel. For close work like this, he was using open express sights. Since its introduction in 1912, thousands of sports and professional hunters had proved the .375 Holland & Holland to be the most versatile and effective rifle ever to have been brought to Africa. It had all the virtues of inherent accuracy and moderate recoil, while the 300-grain solid bullet was a ballistic marvel, with flat trajectory and extraordinary penetration. Johnny aimed at the head of the leading cow, at the crease of the trunk between her myopic old eyes. The report was sharp as the lash of a bullwhip, and an ostrich feather of dust flew from the surface of her weathered grey skin at the precise point upon her skull at which he had aimed. The bullet sliced through her head as easily as a steel nail driven through a ripe apple. It obliterated the top of her brain, and the cow's front legs folded under her, and Daniel felt the earth jump under his feet as she crashed down in a cloud of dust. Johnny swung his aim onto the second cow just as she came level with the carcass of her sister. He reloaded without taking the butt of the rifle from his shoulder, merely flicking the bolt back and forward. The spent brass case was flung high in a glinting parabola, and he fired again. The sound of the two rifle shots blended into each other. They were fired so swiftly as to cheat the ear into hearing a single prolonged detonation. Once again the bullet struck exactly where it had been aimed, and the cow died as the other had done, instantaneously. Her legs collapsed, and she dropped and lay on her belly, with her shoulder touching that of her sister. In the centre of each of their foreheads, a misty pink plume of blood erupted from the tiny bullet holes. Behind them, the herd was thrown into confusion. The bewildered beasts milled and circled, treading the grass flat and raising a curtain of dust that swirled upon them, blanketing the scene so their forms looked ethereal and indistinct in the dust cloud. The calves huddled for shelter beneath their mother's bellies, their ears flattened against their skulls with terror, and they were battered and kicked and thrown about by the frantic movements of their dams. The rangers closed in, firing steadily. The sound of gunfire was a long, continuous rattle like hail on a tin roof. They were shooting for the brain. At each shot, one of the animals flinched or flung up its head, as the solid bullets cracked on the bone of the skull with the sound of a well-struck golf ball. At each shot, one of the animals went down dead or stunned. Those killed cleanly, and they were the majority, collapsed at the back legs first and dropped with the dead weight of a maize sack. When the bullet missed the brain but passed close to it, the elephant reeled and staggered and went down kicking, to roll on its side with a terrible despairing moan and grope helplessly at the sky with lifted trunk. One of the young calves was trapped and pinned beneath its mother's collapsing carcass and lay broken-backed and squealing in a mixture of pain and panic. Some of the elephants found themselves hemmed in by a palisade of fallen animals, and they reared up and tried to scramble over them. The marksmen shot them down so that they fell upon the bodies of those already dead, while others tried to climb over these and were in their turn shot down. It was swift. Within minutes all the adult animals were down, lying close together or piled upon each other in bleeding mounds and hillocks. Only the calves were still racing in bewildered circles, stumbling over the bodies of the dead and dying, squealing and tugging at the carcasses of their mothers. The riflemen walked forward slowly, a tightening ring of gunmetal around the decimated herd. They fired and reloaded and fired again as they closed in. They picked off the calves, and when there remained not a single standing animal, they moved quickly into the herd, scrambling over the gigantic sprawling bodies, pausing only to fire a finishing bullet into each huge bleeding head. Most often there was no response to the second bullet in the brain, but occasionally an elephant not yet dead shuddered and straightened its limbs and blinked its eyes at the shot, then slumped lifelessly. Within 6 minutes of Johnny's first shot, a silence fell over the killing ground on Long Flay. Only their ears still sang to the brutal memory of gunfire. There was no movement. The elephant lay in windrows, like wheat behind the blades of the mower, and the dry earth soaked up the blood. The rangers were still standing apart from each other, subdued and awed by the havoc they had wrought, staring with remorse at the mountain of the dead. 50 elephant, 200 tons of carnage. Johnny Inzu broke the tragic spell that held them. He walked slowly to where the 2 old cows laid at the head of the herd. They lay side by side, shoulders touching, with their legs folded neatly under them, kneeling as though still alive, with only the pulsing fountain of lifeblood from their foreheads to spoil the illusion. Johnny set the butt of his rifle on the ground and leaned upon it, studying the 2 old matriarchs for a long, regretful moment. He was unaware that Jock was filming him. His actions and his words were completely unstudied and unrehearsed.
Hambagashli Amakulu, he whispered. Go in peace, old grandmothers. You are together in death as you were in life. Go in peace and forgive us what we have done to your tribe.
He walked away to the edge of the tree line. Daniel did not follow him. He understood that Johnny wanted to be alone for a while now. The other arrangers also avoided each other. There was no banter nor self-congratulation. 2 of them wandered amongst the mountainous dead with a strangely disconsolate air. A 3rd squatted where he had fired his last shot, smoking a cigarette and studying the dusty ground between his feet, while the last one had laid aside his rifle and, with hands thrust in his pockets and shoulders hunched, stared at the sky and watched the vultures gather. At first the carrion birds were tiny specks against the glaring alps of cumulus cloud, like grains of pepper sprinkled on a tablecloth. Then they soared closer overhead, forming circling squadrons, turning on their wide wings in orderly formations, a dark wheel of death high above the killing ground, and their shadows flitted over the piled carcasses in the centre of Long Flay. 40 minutes later, Daniel heard the rumble of the approaching trucks and saw them coming slowly through the forest. A squad of half-naked axemen ran ahead of the convoy, cutting out the brush and making a rough track for them to follow. Johnny stood up with obvious relief from where he had been sitting alone at the edge of the trees and came to take charge of the butchering. The piles of dead elephant were pulled apart with winches and chains. Then the wrinkled grey skin was sliced through down the length of the belly and the spine. Again the electric winches were brought into play and the skin was flensed off the carcass with a crackling sound as the subcutaneous tissue released its grip. It came off in long slabs, grey and corrugated on the outside, gleaming white on the inside. The men laid each strip on the dusty earth and heaped coarse salt upon it. The naked carcasses looked strangely obscene in the bright sunlight, wet and marbled with white fat and exposed scarlet muscle, the swollen bellies bulging as though to invite the stroke of the flensing knives. A skinner slipped the curved point of the knife into the belly of one of the old cows at the point where it met the sternum. Carefully controlling the depth of the cut so as not to puncture the entrails, he walked the length of the body, drawing the blade like a zipper down the belly pouch, so that it gaped open and the stomach sac bulged out, glistening like the silk of a parachute. Then the colossal coils of the intestines slithered after it. These seemed to have a separate life. Like the body of an awakening python, they twisted and unfolded under the impetus of their own slippery weight. The chainsaw men set to work. The intrusive clatter of the two-stroke engines seemed almost sacrilegious in this place of death, and the exhausts blew snorting blue smoke into the bright air. They lopped the limbs off each carcass, and a fine mush of flesh and bone chips flew in a spray from the teeth of the spinning steel chains. Then they buzzed through the spine and ribs, and the carcasses fell into separate parts that were winched into the waiting refrigerator trucks. A special gang went from carcass to carcass with long boat hooks, poking in the soft wet mounds of spilled entrails to drag out the wombs of the females. Daniel watched as they split open one of the engorged wombs, dark purple with its covering of enlarged blood vessels. From the fetal sac, in a flood of amniotic fluid, the fetus, the size of a large dog, slid out and lay in the trampled grass. It was only a few weeks from term, a perfect little elephant covered with a coat of reddish hair that it would have lost soon after birth. It was still alive, moving its trunk feebly. "Kill it," Daniel ordered harshly in Cinderbelly. It was improbable that it could feel pain, but he turned away in relief as one of the men struck off the tiny head with a single blow of his panga. Daniel felt nauseated, but he knew that nothing from the cull should be wasted. The skin of the unborn elephant would be fine-grained and valuable, worth a few $100 for a handbag or a briefcase. To distract himself, he walked away across the killing ground. All that remained now were the heads of the great animals and the glistening piles of their entrails. From the guts, nothing of value could be salvaged, and they would be left for the vultures and hyena and jackal. The ivory tusks, still embedded in their castles of bone, were the most precious part of the cull. The poachers and the ivory hunters of old would not risk damaging them with a careless axe stroke, and customarily would leave the ivory in the skull until the cartilaginous sheath that held it secure rotted and softened and released its grip. Within 4 or 5 days, the tusks could usually be drawn by hand, perfect and unmarked. However, there was no time to waste on this procedure. The tusks must be cut out by hand. The skinners who did this were the most experienced men, usually older, with grey woolly heads and blood-stained loincloths. They squatted beside the heads and tapped patiently with their native axes. While they were engaged in this painstaking work, Daniel stood with Johnny Inzu. Jock held the Sony VTR on them, as Daniel commented. "Gory work, but necessary," Johnny agreed shortly. "On an average, Each adult elephant will yield about $3,000 worth in ivory, skin and meat. To many people that will sound pretty commercial, especially as they have just witnessed the hard reality of the cull. Daniel shook his head. You must know, Warden, that there's a very strong campaign led by the animal rights groups to have the elephant placed on Appendix 1 of CITES. That is the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species.
Yes, I know.
If that happens, it would prohibit the trade in any elephant products, skin, ivory or meat. What do you think of that, Warden?
It makes me very angry.
Johnny dropped his cigarette and ground it under his heel. His expression was savage.
It would prevent any further culling operations, wouldn't it? Daniel persisted.
Not at all, Johnny contradicted him. We would still be forced to control the size of the herds. We would still be forced to cull. The only difference would be that we could not sell the elephant products. They would be wasted. A tragic criminal waste. We would lose millions of dollars of revenue which at present is being used to protect and enlarge and service the wildlife sanctuaries.
Johnny broke off and watched as a tusk was lifted out of the channel in the spongy bone of the skull by two of the skinners and laid carefully on the dry brown grass. Skillfully, one of them drew the nerve. A soft grey, gelatinous core from the hollow end of the tusk. Then Johnny went on.
That tusk makes it easier for us to justify the continued existence of the parks and the animals they contain to the local tribespeople living in close contact with wild animals on and near the boundaries of the national wilderness areas.
I don't understand, Daniel encouraged him. Do you mean the local tribes resent the parks and the animal population?
Not if they can derive some personal benefit from them. If we can prove to them that a cow elephant is worth $3,000 and that a foreign safari hunter will spend $50,000 or even $100,000 to hunt a trophy bull, if we can show them that a single elephant is worth $100,000, even $1,000 of their goats or scrawny cattle, and that they will see some of that money coming to them and their tribe, then they will see the point of conserving the heads.
You mean the local peasants do not place a value on wildlife simply for its own sake?
Johnny laughed bitterly. That is a first-world luxury and affectation. The tribes here live very close to subsistence level. We are talking about an average family income of $120 a year.
$10 a month?
They cannot afford to set aside land and grazing for a beautiful but useless animal to live on. If the wild game is to survive in Africa, it has to pay for its supper. There are no free rides in this harsh land.
One would think that living so close to nature, they would have an instinctive feel for it, Daniel persisted.
Yes, of course, but it is totally pragmatic. For millennia, primitive man, living with nature, has treated it as a renewable resource. As the Eskimo lived on the caribou and seal and whale, or the American Indian on buffalo herds, they understood instinctively the type of management that we have never achieved. They were in balance with nature, until the white man came with explosive harpoons and Sharp's rifles, or here in Africa came with his elite game department and game laws that made it a crime for the black tribesman to hunt on his own land, that reserved the wildlife of Africa for a select few to stare at and exclaim over.
You are being a racist, Daniel chided him gently. The old colonial system preserved the wild game.
So how did it survive for a million years before the white man arrived in Africa?
No, the colonial system of game management was protectionist, not conservationist.
Aren't they the same thing, protection and conservation?
No, they are diametrically opposed. The protectionist denies man's right to exploit and harvest nature's bounty. He would deny that man has a right to kill a living animal, even if that threatens the survival of the species as a whole. If he were here today, the protectionist would prohibit us from this cull. And he would not want to look to the final consequence of that prohibition, which, as we have seen, would be the eventual extinction of the entire elephant population and the destruction of this forest. However, the most damaging mistake that the old colonial protectionists made was to alienate the black tribesmen from the benefits of controlled conservation. They denied him his share of the spoils and built up in him a resentment towards the wild game. They broke down his
natural instinct for management of his resources. They took away his control of nature and placed him in competition with the animals. The end result is that the average black peasant is hostile towards the game. The elephants raid his gardens and destroy the trees he uses for firewood. The buffalo and antelope eat the grass on which he feeds his cattle. The crocodile ate his grandmother, and the lion killed his father. Of course he has come to resent the game herds.